Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dad.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And we need studio audience or something. Somebody to applaud us that we are proud of saying our own names.
Well, actually, I got the radio voice and another exciting episode from when I was a kid, back in the dark ages.
Who was that masked man?
I actually used to listen to radio drama. And some of them started off. Another exciting episode of The Lone Ranger.
Was that in black and white?
It was pre-black and white. It was the Dark Ages.
So it was, you just had to close your eyes to watch this.
No, you didn't. You closed your eyes. You watched the radio.
It's amazing.
And
was it? Is it like an app? Is that how it was working?
It's more like a box. Like a box from Amazon, except it wasn't a box. It was a box. It had a dial on it.
Some of those were made from wood from Amazon forests.
Well, I don't know about the Amazon forests. I don't think we imported things from the Amazon forests.
We did. There was a lot of wood that came from the Amazon at that point.
We used to listen to WLS Chicago. We were in Oklahoma, and we could listen at night to WLS Chicago, which stood for World's Largest Store because it was owned by Sears.
So what you're telling me is that you were born in another century.
I was born in another millennium. I was born so long ago. It's pretty amazing. I mean, it wasn't reruns of radio drama. It was actual radio drama. And we haven't done our disclosures. We already have a call on 773-1400.
Right.
By the way, the telephone number to call in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to talk to us. And today is the 15th of February, 2020. And we have a caller on 773-1400.
Don't forget about disclosures.
I won't forget about the disclosures and disclaimers.
So caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. You got my curiosity going on that. That radio you listened to, was that a Motorola or a Zenith or just any other?
I think it was a Zenith. My grandmother had a Motorola, but where I was actually living at the time, we had a Zenith because Motorolas were too expensive.
Well, I should tell you that I have a Zenith.
You do?
Tube-operated radio, dome-topped. It's a big cabinet.
You actually use it?
I'm in the process of restoring it to get the tubes working again, but there's not much it can pick up anymore. It can pick up AM.
Well, that's it, AM. It was AM we listened to, and we listened to it late at night.
This was your mother-in-law's when she was young. So I have that, and I'm restoring it. I've got to recreate a knob on there. I've got to get some of the veneer fixed up. But it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And the tubes on there are longer than my arms bent. So there's two of them, and they're maybe 3 feet long, but they go up, and then they bend at the top and have a crease, and then they come back down. It's fascinating.
It's magical stuff.
Tube-operated, magical, phosphorescent.
You could turn the radio around and look at the back of it, and all the tubes were glowing in there. It was really cool. I remember when my mother first got a solid-state radio with a battery.
Oh. I remember you talking to me
about an hour.
Your transistor radio that you used to listen to in bed.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, we need to do disclosures and disclaimers.
I don't know why you didn't just use your iPhone. It would have been a lot more convenient than working on it.
Your sister, when I was trying to explain she was doing a paper on Thomas Edison and his most significant invention, according to the...
It was the phonograph?
According to the...
The article at the time?
The article was the phonograph. And she said, what's a phonograph? And I tried to explain it to her.
Well, it's like a picture of a phone.
No,
that's not it. That's not it.
It was a... and this was still quite a while ago.
Cylindrical
record player. She didn't know what a record player was.
She knew that you can break records.
So I said, you used a needle instead of a laser on it. To pick up the vibrations.
This was enough years ago that we were still using CDs. We don't even use lasers anymore.
And she said, why didn't they use lasers? I said, because they didn't exist. And she said, no. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this riveting, as in hot and painful.
Hot and painful, riveted together.
Yes. Radio program. It's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm that's a fiduciary firm that is a wealth management folks. in Salado, Texas, registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. We say that not because they approve or disapprove of us, but
they don't,
our regulators.
They don't approve of anything, but when they disapprove, they'll let you know. Very, very clearly, they'll let you know.
And basically, if a firm has more than $100 million under discretionary management, it gets registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. If it has less than $100 million under management, it gets registered with the state. And we're registered with the SEC, which means we have more than $100 million under management. That's really the only difference.
Yep.
We're considered
but
large.
When we're on this radio program, we're not giving fiduciary investment advice because that's literally impossible. We don't know all of you. I'd like to know all of you. That'd be really cool.
I'm not sure I'd like to know all of you.
There may be a few of you I don't want to know.
Yeah, but there'd be too many people to try to know.
It's a lot of people listening.
Well, maybe both
of them. So anything we say on the program is meant to educate you into making better decisions, but it's not advice. And that seems pretty obvious, but it's something we have to be very clear on. It's just like the program before us, you've got an attorney. If you call up and say, should I declare bankruptcy? He's going to say, come to my office and let's talk about it. Because if he says yes and all of you declare bankruptcy, he may have a little bit of
liability. Wait a minute. Now, his the radio advertisement that he plays on his show says, what are you waiting for?
Right. It's true. And I've told him, I'm giving him marketing advice. I'm trying hard. I'm like, you should just set up a buy one, get one free deal. Get a divorce, get a bankruptcy
free.
Well,
they do go together.
Something like that. That would be a great marketing campaign. But he just smiles at me and shakes his head a little bit.
Sometimes he doesn't even smile.
Yeah, most of the time.
It takes a long time
smile.
To get through the disclosure.
He kind of starts glaring me sometimes.
We have another caller on 254-773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. One of the impacts of the coronavirus, according to Wall Street, is parts are starting to dry up in this country, specifically in the automotive industry, and it could affect literally thousands and thousands of jobs. Do you think that once this crisis is over, hopefully, businesses are going to rethink where they source parts and maybe bring some of that stuff back to the U.S.? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Good question.
That's a good question. It's multi-part, though.
I'm going to
– wait.
Let me pull this thing up. You start the answer
answer. Think about
– the parts drying up?
Think about all the answers while we finish the disclosure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Go ahead with the disclosure.
We do not get paid to do this radio program, but we don't pay KTEM to do the radio program. We do advertise for the program on KTEM. And why I have to tell you that? Because I have to tell you that. The information we present on here has been obtained from sources that we deem to be deemed. I get to use deemed.
Yes, it's very
deemed
deeming.
To be reliable and consistent and accurate, but we make no warranty or guarantee as the completeness or accuracy of any information we present on this radio program. Is there anything else?
You said the advertisement thing.
Yeah.
Said the, yep, I think that's it.
Okay. Now we can go on to the question from the caller.
Yeah.
What do you want me to take?
Well, I can jump in with, I've been following a law blog.
Hey, let's summarize this.
Okay.
Is the SARS epidemic?
No.
Not SARS.
Coronavirus.
Is the coronavirus epidemic
going
to affect our economy because parts they should be moistened so they don't dry up?
They're not drying. Well, they are.
Yes. They're drying up. Is it going to affect?
Yes.
Yeah. And the answer to that one's very simple.
Yes. Yes, it's going to affect our economy.
What was the second part of the question?
Well, do you think outsourcing and supply chain stuff, is that going to come back to the United States?
No.
So my answer to that is I follow there's a website, and I recommend it, China Law Blog, if you've watched .com. If you've watched Arrested Development, you may get – anytime somebody says law blog, I get confused for a minute and want to start quoting from Arrested Development. But China Law Blog, it's Harrison Bricken, which is an international law firm that has a preponderance of their clientele – in doing business in China. So they represent companies that want to do business elsewhere in the world. And for a long time, a huge chunk of their business has been in China. Starting with the trade war and then going into the coronavirus, they're saying some things that we don't get from the official picture from China. The things that they were saying, I've talked about it a bit on this program, about the small corporations doing manufacturing in China are seeing a large uptick in really nasty behavior toward them from the factory company in China. Like, they'll send a prototype that looks great. You order a thousand of them and they all come in subpar. You go to say, hey, let's renegotiate our contract, and they bail on the negotiation, and the next thing you know, they are selling your products online. There's a big uptick in that since the trade war started, because what was happening before that is the factory company, which in China, in order, just like here, in order to do business here, you've got to follow American labor laws. In China, they have a different set of labor laws, but you have to follow them, and they're less about protecting the laborer and more about protecting China in general. But basically, it says you've got to work with a Chinese company, not just come and establish your own company here and hire people. So Apple in China doesn't employ anyone on a factory floor. They employ a company that employs the people on the factory floor. That's kind of across the board. And to negotiate those contracts, this is the role that Harris and Bricken have filled in the past. And I have never used their services. I've read the blog for a long time and found it to be quite accurate. So what they're saying with coronavirus is that it's a big deal, folks. There are lots and lots and lots of factories, not just in the affected regions, but elsewhere as well, that still have not opened up from the Chinese New Year's holiday. And that's been about 2.5 weeks now. And the Chinese government is starting to crack down on that. They're starting to force people out to go to jobs. How's that for fun? When the government shows up and says, go to work or else. Well, that's happening in China. It's a different environment, and they're kind of expect it. They kind of, I don't know if they want it, but they kind of expect it, that this is going to happen. The end result is if you're, and this is what they're saying in this post, they're working and recommending that people move their supply chain. They've been recommending slowly.
The
Harris and Bricken, right, are recommending to their clients to move their supply chain out of China. They were recommending it before coronavirus based on the responses to small businesses. So they don't represent any megalithic companies. They represent a lot of companies that have factories in China, but they're relatively small. I mean, you're still talking about tens or hundreds of millions of dollars a year type companies, but they're not billions upon billions a year. And their recommendation is based on, in China, the attitude towards America has shifted so drastically since the trade war started. Here, we're kind of like, yeah, China, they're not there. But when we look at an item and it says made in China on it, we kind of shrug our shoulders because everything's made in China and we still buy the thing. And I recommend to anybody to look at the politicians that are saying stay away from China and ask them if they're buying anything from China, because they are. And unless they're living like a hermit somewhere with no anything, they're buying things from China. So, yes, the supply chain's moving, but unfortunately not to the United States.
Well, it can't move to the United States.
We don't have enough workers.
Several surveys came out about business this last week, and they're saying things are not bad from the consumer buying perspective. They've leveled off, but they're not bad. What they are concerned about, and one of the reasons they're not investing in their businesses, is because they can't hire new people. There are just no people to hire. I mean, the people that show up are generally unqualified, and they can't.
They're generally people. The people that are being hired right now are people that have not been in the workforce for about a decade.
And the issue is that we can't move. It's not a bilateral issue between us and China. We can't move production back to the United States because there's simply no. We do not have the capacity. Unless we up immigration dramatically,
and this is something
to do that.
We've been talking about capacity utilization in the United States, and anybody that's listened to us for the past several years, almost any episode, we talk about capacity utilization. We're at our maximum for railroads, we've actually come down just a little bit from the maximum on the railroads, in the highways, in the waterways, in every method of transporting goods inside our country, we're very close to the absolute maximum, which means if you want more stuff, we either have to figure out how to stack it higher on the semis and maybe jack up the bridges a couple of extra feet to make them fit.
Isn't that what PhDs are for?
No, those are post hole diggers.
No,
you just go
piled,
down and
piled higher and deeper.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that'll do it. So that's our issue, is that we're at, you know, we see this, it's being trumpeted. It's amazing. It's
trumpeted.
Fantastic. Yes, trumpeted. It's great. We're at record low unemployment. We have hired more people than at any time in history, which means that if you want to expand your business,
you can't.
You can't, because there's not enough people to hire anymore.
If you wanted to expand your business and you could hire more workers, you couldn't, because you would need to have somebody build more buildings and there's nobody to build the buildings.
So here's my thought. At some point, we'll have a recession. And when that happens, there will probably be a lot of automative and robotic solutions to what we're talking about coming out of the recession. Because when people are spending less, especially if people are, if companies are in the process of moving a supply chain from somewhere, that's an expensive move. It is not cheap to move a supply chain.
And the other thing is,
but
if you've invested $5 billion in a factory in China and you just walk away from it, nobody is going to buy it from you for $5
billion. No, nobody's going to buy that. You basically are giving it to the Chinese company that was running it before. So when you move the supply chain, there's a big hit to price. If people are buying less in that process, that's a really good, you know, normal event that takes place that leads to recessions. And that's not a bad thing, because the recessions, when people are out of work, it's a bad thing to be out of work, but it's where we innovate. So what we're going to see is a lot of the people that are complaining right now about not having enough people. And man, if I had the time, I'd really invent something that would replace these people in this industry. When the industry cuts back, those people are going to have nothing to do but tinker in their garage with the solution that they want right now, but they don't have time to make.
I don't think they'll be doing it much in garages, but I got your point.
Yeah, I mean, they may be. The prototyping in garages for electronic stuff and robotic stuff, that's where it takes mm-hmm. place. It really literally is in somebody's garage. I mean, I've got... You've seen my garage.
I've seen your garage.
And
it's full of high-tech stuff that I don't even half understand.
It's just cobbled together with solder and duct tape because it's all prototype stuff. And the reason why that's possible right now, so this is a little bit weird, is because of China. The ability for me to buy a microprocessor on a board that does all the things that I need it to do to automate the movement of a robot, to write software to make that robot be smart. But I can buy that microprocessor and board, and I'm talking about Arduinos, Raspberry Pis. You're talking about, for top-of-the-line items there, less than $50. And it's because of the manufacturing techniques and just the preponderance of people allowed to do manufacturing in China. That can be moved, but before we're too harsh on China, we have to also accept that everything that we're doing right now is less expensive because of the relationship that we've had with China. So we've got good and bad in this relationship. And a lot of times people just want to concentrate on one or the other. It depends on your political party right now, whether you think relationship with China should be all good or all bad. If you're Democrat, you tend to lean that China's a great place and you just leave them alone. And then the Republicans are more like, hey, China's horrible. And
actually,
it's somewhere in the middle.
I'll disagree with you there. There's apparently a bipartisan agreement at this point in Congress that China's bad.
There are, well, yeah, bipartisan in that some of the Democrats believe that as well, but the majority are still saying, hey, this is something that we worked on for a long time and let's just have a nice agreement with them somewhere.
The issue about whether it'll return to the United States, automation will gradually return it, if you will, to the United States, but it won't mean more people being hired here. It'll actually result in if we follow history, in the 2020s, we will see some significant unemployment.
Yeah.
Because the recession between now and then, whenever it occurs, as Jake said, will cause a lot of automated processes that are already developed. They're already ready to employ.
Right. The software already exists doing it for some other thing. The hardware already exists doing it for some other thing. That means all of the automated stuff that we need right now is the parts are already on the shelf. We just have to put them together. And we don't have time to do that right now because we're all working so hard to meet the deadlines at our jobs that are paying us more than they've paid in the past and that everybody got a job. So there we are.
But there'll be a lot of things that are labor intensive that still won't come, that still won't be done here. And recently we saw that the imports from China have been dropping, which is pretty reasonable.
Mm-hmm. They're getting more expensive.
At the same time, imports from Vietnam have been rising dramatically, and it's not just stuff they're shipping across the border and shipping out of Vietnam that really came from China.
Real stuff.
We're moving supply chains to Vietnam. We're moving supply chains to Thailand. We're moving supply chains to Indonesia. You notice India is not too much on the list because India is having its problems of its own.
Yeah, big ones.
But we need low-cost labor outside the United States, a lot of it, to make the things that we want to buy. And our balance of trade issue with Europe and with Asia and with South America is not bad. It simply means that our economy, if you've been following it at all, is doing very, very well. We have a lot of excess money to spend. We had a big tax cut. We have a lot of excess money to spend. We don't have the capacity to make the things in the United States that we want to spend the money on. So companies, because you go to the store, you go to Walmart, you go to Target, you go to wherever you go, and you want something. You go to the grocery store, and you want fresh flowers, and you want fresh vegetables.
They didn't come from here, most likely. Some of them did.
In the wintertime, they come from someplace else, and they only come because you want them, and you're willing to pay for them. And you don't want to pay too much, and that's where we can get them, and we fly them in here. That's the reality is our average American is so well off is the reason we have a balance of trade issue. We really don't have, by the way, and we've discussed this before. We really don't have a balance of trade issue. We have full employment in the United States. Why do we want to bring jobs home if there's nobody to work at them? I'm just a little curious about that.
A direct example of this. The trade war, when it first started, was based on steel and aluminum. Right before that, we had some solar panel issues and some washer and dryers, so washing machines, dryers, from South Korea. So we're not talking about the whole world yet. We just had some tariffs on South Korea on some washers and dryers. Then we moved forward and said, for the whole world, steel and aluminum. Why? Well, because we're dependent on the world for steel and aluminum. And the president said that's not a good idea, and I tend to agree. It'd be nice if we were producing all of our stuff. We're not in that place. We were producing, at that point, 73% of our own steel. Here is something that talks to your point that you were just making about physical hard labor and us outsourcing it. 73% of our own steel, that sounds bad, but it's still, if you were in a public school, that's a passing grade. 2% of our own iron is mined here. That, to me, is a massive strategic problem. And the reason is because it's hard and dangerous work to mine for iron. But Alcoa's wrapped up its aluminum shops in Texas, its aluminum foundries and refining facilities. There's iron mines right there as well. We were producing iron up into the 90s in Texas. But it's been cheaper to import iron or to get recycled iron. And one of the things that's taken place in the shift during the trade war is that aluminum has now gotten to the point where the majority of the aluminum that we use in the United States is recycled, which to me is really good because anybody that's listened to us, this is a small change in the subject, if you don't mind. We're just going to take a rabbit trail off to recycling. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody that's listened to us for very long knows that we have a very interesting view on recycling. I tend to look at recycling the way that it was looked at when you had the deposit deal on your glass bottles. You could take it back to the store and get some money for it. There's still places that do that because glass is eminently recyclable. Aluminum is eminently recyclable. It's just heated up again, get the dross out, and there's a little bit of impurities. For instance, like an aluminum can that you drink your soda out of, your Coke, your Pepsi, whatever it is, has about 1% of something else in it. The paint on the can, the coating
on the inside.
The coating on the inside that preserves the flavor and so that it doesn't absorb the aluminum.
Right. You don't wind up with drinking aluminum, which is bad.
Because if you have any kind of carbonated beverage, they have acid in there and it would eat at the aluminum slowly and it would add. So there's coating in there. It's less than 1% of the weight. We're at now, the vast majority of the aluminum we use is recycled. When we talk about plastics, on the other hand, there's just a very few types of plastic where it makes sense to recycle them. It's actually, and if you come at it from the ecology side or from the economy side, it doesn't really matter. It's more expensive with a lot of plastic to make new plastic out of it than to make new plastic out of something else. That's monetarily. Also with carbon emissions, there are, like, HDP plastic is the exception that's kind of across the board. It's a food grade thing. You warm it up and it's what they make the cutting boards out of. And that kind of plastic has a very, very low, melting point. It becomes plastic. You see what I did there?
I like that.
At a lower heated temperature than others. So it doesn't take as much energy to reshape it, and it doesn't take as much energy to get it back and ready to sell again for something else. So milk cartons and or milk jugs and that sort of thing, that's HDP. This big move to recycle that's been put on by people afraid for the ecology works really well with aluminum and steel and glass and HDP plastic, and really, really poorly for a lot of other things. Cardboard is great for recycling. If you've ever shredded a document and put it in the recycler, you've messed up because they can't recycle that. So the recycling area, it's amazing to me because people talk about this like it's an ecological thing. It's not an ecological thing. It's an economical thing. And as soon as we start looking at it that way, that's when things actually start getting changed for a better direction. If you look at what happens at a butchering or slaughter facility, I know the left is going to say, oh, this is a horrible, horrible thing. When I was in school, I'd read about, you know, the Native Americans using every piece of the animals that they killed. And it's stated like it's a, you know, it's an amazing thing and we should aspire to do that. Economically, it's also a very good idea, and slaughterhouses use everything. We get gelatin out of this stuff. We get leather out of this. There's nothing that's not used.
Mostly we get hot dogs.
Lots of hot dogs. Yeah. So we use everything. So from a business perspective, recycling is a really good idea. If it's economical. If it's not economical, then there's probably something wrong ecologically with it as well. It's just one of those weird situations where if it's a wasteful process, it tends to be wasteful on money and in chemical and heat, temperatures and carbon emissions and other things that go up in there. So it's one of those things where I don't feel like the business community should be at odds with the ecological community or whether it's a good idea to recycle. And pretty much they're not. Recycling takes place all over. But as we saw when China, before the trade war, said we're not accepting contaminated recyclable material anymore and basically shut down 99% of the stuff we were sending to them, all of our recycle programs are in chaos right now. Most of the plastic that you recycle right now, and it almost doesn't matter where you live, there are just a few places in the country that this doesn't count in, it's going into the landfill. That's just, and you're paying extra money to the recycling company to put it in the landfill. That's what's happening right now because we don't have the facilities to recycle because China was doing it before. We could start new companies in recycling here in the United States, and some people have done that, but they're not able to expand quickly enough. There's a couple of places in Michigan. There's a couple of places up in the Midwest that have started these really grand ideas, and they have a lot of startup money that got poured into them, and they're slowly growing. And they're like, "Do you need more money? What do you need?" And I'm like, "No, then we need more people. Everybody has a job. We can't hire anybody to do this." That's where we are. The expansion on all these new ideas, it's going to require some things to break and need fixing first before we can expand again. And that's unfortunately the method of any economic cycle, is that it goes really well based on the last repair job we did. We repaired it really well, guys. It's lean, mean. We're going to do this so efficiently until we start doing it well. And we need to bring in more people, and our efficiency starts dropping. Our productivity starts dropping. And then something breaks and we go, "Man, we can't do that again. Let's make it lean, mean." It's a cycle. And that's where we are. We're right now at the top of that.
To
cycle.
Give you a bottom line, we have a choice in this country, and we seem to be making the choice. And that is, we can either export a lot of jobs because we don't have people to work here, or we can allow large scale immigration, which we did, by the way, 100 years ago from Eastern Europe. We can allow large scale immigration and put those people to work.
Which
is where our ancestors came
right.
from, by the way.
Third option is we spend a lot of money on automation, and you buy a lot of money, it means we would have to hire the brains to do it from places where they're already getting paid really nicely. So we would have to up that pay to get them to come out and start something new that has no evidence of profitability yet.
Automation, though, requires a lot of business investment.
That's exactly what I was
and
just
we're
saying.
We're not doing business investment right now, and there's some very good reasons for that. There's two reasons that business investment is declining and continues to decline, which, by the way, indicates we will have a downturn coming because we're not investing for the future in businesses. There's two really good reasons we're not doing it. One, we don't have enough people to make it make sense. In other words, if a business says, "I'm going to buy a bunch of new machines to make more stuff because there's demand."
But we're not going to get rid of the old machines because we're using those and they're effective.
The problem is you have to hire new people, and you have to have a new building, and you have to build all that stuff, and that doesn't work.
Right. You got to hire the people to build it, and there aren't that many people that do that anymore, so it takes a while.
And the other thing is, if we're going to do something that's innovative, that we couldn't import it cheaper. I mean, if you can import it cheaper than you can build it yourself, you had a choice between buying something from China and buying something from the United States. By the way, you have on many occasions. You can go to an expensive niche store and buy clothing from the United States, made in the United States.
I don't need any niches, thank you.
And it's going to cost you a lot of money, but you don't do that. You go to Walmart, I started to say Kmart, but that tells how old I am.
Yeah, you could go to Kmart, but their selection's really low.
And you could go to Men's Warehouse, you can go to wherever, but you're probably buying clothes that were made overseas, because those same clothes, if they're made by a tailor in the United States, are going to be outrageously expensive. So you make the same choice that industry is making.
There's an exception. And I mean, you throw this in. Louis Vuitton just opened up a factory here in Texas, up near Keene, which is south of Fort Worth. And they have a bunch of American workers in there, but they can do that because they charge multiple $1,000s per small purse. they can afford American wages at that level.
The issue is really simple. We can go to automation, which takes a lot of capital investment that's not there right now. We can import jobs, but we can bring the jobs back, but we have to bring people to do them, which we chose not to do. So the only alternative is to buy parts and things from outside the United States. And we have,
when the virus is hit.
Let's face it, we are in a global economy. We can't turn the clock back.
Wait, I have a statement that we should coin. Let's face it, we're in a global world now.
True. We're in a global economy, and there is no major economy on the planet that can exist without the global support. It just doesn't happen. China imports most, if not all, almost all of its raw materials. China imports a lot. As a matter of fact, they became a net importer, a year or two ago?
Yeah, they're back to net No, they're still net importer because their exports are down a little bit. So
the point is that no matter where you are in the world, you can't turn the clock back to the 1950s and 1960s, and we don't want to turn the clock back to the 50s or 60s.
No, as much as it's nice to be nostalgic about the Zenith radio playing, I do like my smartphone.
And I like my flat screen TV. And so the answer to your question is we're never going to be able to turn the clock back, and we're never going to bring jobs home. Because we don't have anybody to work at them.
And that's never, ever, ever been the case. You never bring jobs home. New technology comes along to create new jobs. We had this talk on Zeniths that the Zenith went out of business, and all televisions were now being made outside of the United States. It was a big deal in the late 90s or mid 90s. And that what they were building is no longer what we consider a television. It's something completely different now. New technology came along, and there are screens being made in the United States now. Most of them are still being made elsewhere. VCRs got outsourced, and people said, look, we need to bring back all the VCR jobs. Well, we didn't. Well, we didn't, because we went on to making CD players, and we went on to doing other things. We have also, in the United States, for the preponderance of the last half century, educated our workforce more and more and more, so that when they lose a job in one place, they get a better job at some point. That's not in every case, but that's on average. The problem with that is we're doing less investment in that area as well now. So there's some things that we believe that as a whole, the United States need to be thinking about investing in. And we've got some commercials to play. You're looking at your watch over there.
Because it's time to play commercials.
Yeah, let's do it. If you would like to call into the conversation, you want to give the number?
Personal Wealth Coach on the radio, or if you're at www.ktmnews.com or on the app, you can give us a call if today is the 15th of February 2020 at 254-773-1400.
And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is the 15th of February, 2020, you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. We have a caller waiting patiently, I hope. And caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello, caller.
Caller's gone.
Hello, caller, my old friend. Anyway, let's talk about the week. The S&P 500 stock index, despite the fact that the coronavirus numbers jumped from about 4,000 to 14,000 in one day, they didn't really, but the numbers did.
The way they measured them.
Yeah. Another exuberant week. It closed out at 3380.16, up 1.58%. Now, you multiply that times 52, and you get a heck of a number.
Yeah, that's not something we think is very reasonable to happen every week, but it's nice when it happens.
It's only up 1.52% for the last month. We got a caller on 773-1400. We'll come back to the market in just a minute. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello.
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 You're
Hello.
On the air. You're on the air.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Hey, first of all, I really appreciate y'all's show. I think you're great. Very educational. I've got kind of a investment retirement question. So we use hypotheticals here. Let's say a man is 62 years old. He's fixing to retire. He's saved, we'll say, $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rule of thumb, if I understand it, is that if you draw about 4% a year off of your nest egg, that the nest egg will pretty well last in perpetuity. And of course, that's contingent on how long a person is going to live, and nobody knows that but the good Lord. So is that 4% number pretty accurate?
Well, it all depends. Do you love that? On the other hand,
the response from the economist.
The school book solution that you're referring to refers to a well-diversified, balanced portfolio. There is the rub. If you have the school book solution is right out of the CFP, little circle R after the CFP, manuals, says that, yeah, 4% has historically been sustainable, even if you retire at precisely the wrong moment. The problem is maintaining a well-diversified, balanced portfolio, because the term diversified is very poorly understood. And the word balanced is very poorly understood. You have to take into account a lot of factors to have a well-diversified, balanced portfolio, which is why, for instance, the TRS pays their pension fund managers big bucks to do that.
TRS is Texas Teachers Retirement System.
And we can't say that your nest egg will last forever if you're taking out 4% a year. What we can say is historically a well-diversified, balanced portfolio has been sustainable at a 4% if you start off day one with a 4% withdrawal.
There are some exceptions to that, though. I mean, if we started you in 1928 and there wasn't a whole lot of diversification available at that point, you basically would have to own all the things you needed to own. That's why the well-diversified statement is so strong.
And there are times, for example, when a well-diversified portfolio has been described as 60% stocks, 40% bonds.
Well, that's not a good
idea.
There's
been some good papers out recently said, and given the current interest rate environment, that's a good way to go broke. So even well-diversified balanced portfolio changes depending on what's going on. We're at record low interest rates. That changes the way the portfolio has to be put together. And secondly, this is the biggie. This is the hard one. If you put together a well-diversified balanced portfolio by the school book, if you had one in 2007, you still would have seen a nearly 50% drop in your portfolio over the next year or so. And if you can't tolerate that, if you can't tolerate the fact that your portfolio is in a panic, and the panics are relatively rare, but in a true market panic, you have to be able to ride out a rather massive decline in your investment portfolio and wait for it to come back.
That's the thing that generally kills a portfolio. The ones that are really well designed. I don't mean like you're just standard, somebody put something together and when a downturn happens and you've got a well-designed portfolio, you have to know that even well-designed portfolios go down in downturns. And that means that you need to have some other methodology in the portfolio designed to pay you while the market's down without taking a whole lot of money out of the market in the process.
And a lot of people recognize this reality, and they've gone over to annuities. But annuities is somebody else managing the money but not letting you see the market go down.
Right. It's the same situation.
And you put you've definitely got a lot of eggs in one basket under that circumstance, because if the annuity company goes under, you just wave goodbye to your money.
I think the bottom line answer here is but with discipline.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, caller.
On that $2 million, a man says, you know, I'm going to, that'll get me, at 4%, $80,000 a year. And of course, from that, if it's been a tax deferred investment in IRAs and whatnot, that you're going to be paying tax off of that and that sort of thing. So at that, and let's say you've got a really good investment advisor and you pay 1% a year.
Right.
So how does that figure on that 4%? Would you really need to take out 5% in order to account for the 1% for the advisor?
That's a really good question.
Or are you really getting 3? Because then, you know, that'd be the difference in $80,000 a year and $60,000.
There is, you've got a very good point there. If your investment advisor is doing his or her job correctly, and this is no guarantee and not to say that we are always capable of doing that, but if you're doing your job correctly, they should be able to get you into investment vehicles at a discount. And that'll make up a lot of that 1%. The other thing is,
and there's always that expenses included in that 4% withdrawal. The 4% net to the client is what you're talking about. And there's a thing that we should add in there when we say well-diversified, balanced portfolio and low-expense positions, well-managed low-expense positions, and those are available.
And the issue is that, very frankly, when the studies were done, they took into account investment advisory fees, and it goes into a different area. It comes out of Dalbar and some other things. The people who have a professional investment advisor tend to get a significantly better long-term return than the people who don't.
And this isn't, now, when because I say they it isn't because the advisors picked better positions. It's because they were just there to tell you not to sell in the downturn.
Well, so the point is that we're looking at investor behavior and investor returns versus market returns. And there's a lot that goes into this. But the using the pure numbers that you just used and using pure indexes, you would say, okay, obviously you'd have to take 1% off of that, only take 3% if you hired a 1% investment advisor. The fact is, study after study, now this is making an assumption, by the way, that you're hiring a professional fiduciary. You're not hiring somebody who's a stockbroker working for a brokerage firm. Who says, I'm also an investment advisor on the side, except I won't really manage the money. The company will manage the money for you, and they'll charge you this much. Now, it becomes a little bit squirrely at that point, because the studies that I've read from Vanguard assume an independent fiduciary investment advisor, and they find out, and sure, lo and behold, the people who do who've used those historically have gotten, and you're going to, this is, I'm just going to, this is strictly a Vanguard study. I didn't do it. They get, and this is astonishing, over a 20-year period, they get a 3% better return per year than the average investor who's not using a fiduciary investment advisor.
And
that they
were,
they really, like Jake said, a big piece of it is modifying the behavior of the clients.
It's not so much, I mean, they do a small amount better than your average investor. The big chunk is just being there to talk to when there's a panic going on and saying, look, these happen.
And there's a lot of, for instance, I'll give you an example of something that is, Jake was talking about it a minute ago. I said, don't use annuity. I would recommend against using annuity companies to get that steady income when the market's down. We instead say, let's go to cash, safe cash positions and short-term bond positions that you can tap into when the market is down.
Now, that means you're still invested with a big chunk of your assets, but you have a reserve that's sitting there available for your income, not if, but when the market goes down. That's, we love the historic returns of the market. It's just been fantastic. We've lived through big chunks of this. And in living through it, we also recognize to get those returns, we got to sit through really nasty downturns. Sometimes they're really, really nasty. But that's the only way you get the long-term return.
And this is the odd thing, that reserve he's talking about, that backup, sometimes that's in longer-term bonds, and sometimes that's in short-term stuff, and knowing when to be in which one is pretty critical.
I think you're absolutely right, and a lot of it is contingent on the person being able to stomach the downturns as well as the upside, and there's no doubt that trying to time the market never works, but most people in that position have been doing this for 20 or 30 years, and they've been through tough times and have seen that that when the market bottoms out, that's not the time to try to sell and sit on it and then time it to try to
Oh, you would be surprised at the people who I have met who have been queuing at 20 or 30 years who really believe it's possible to time the market.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They just feel like they haven't figured it quite out yet, but this time they think they're right. There's a lot of people like that.
I understand. Well, that's an excellent answer, man, and I really appreciate it, and y'all keep up the good work.
And by the way, I want to add one thing. If you have $2 million, you probably can afford to buy the services of a professional investment advisory firm that's not working for a brokerage firm.
Yeah.
Understand. I think that's excellent advice.
All right.
Thank you for the call, sir.
Good call. Good questions.
You bet. Thank you.
It's a complicated issue.
I wish it was easier. I mean, it would put us out of work, but I really do wish that the methodology to invest was something that was really, really thoroughly taught to people, because you're going to be dependent on this stuff the rest of your life.
And they teach a lot of stuff in high school that they really should teach the management of a 401k.
Right.
We are running out of time.
We're almost out of time. We've got a little over a minute left.
There's some things we need to talk about the economy and the market. I guess we'll get to them next hour. And until then, we are the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we are an investment advisory firm, and this ties right into what I was just saying, and I feel self-serving here. We do wealth management for people who have enough money or anticipate having enough money to be financially independent. And we can be reached locally at 254-947-1111.
Or toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got recordings of our radio program going back quite a long ways. At some point, we're actually going to put those up on the podcast network. We just keep being short-staffed enough that we don't have time to get it done.
We're the classic people who are too busy to do the things we really need to do to grow.
Yeah, exactly. So there's newsletters on the site. You can sign up for them there. You can contact us through the website, or you can there's a contact form, or you can email us directly if you have a question you want us to talk about on the air. That's, you know, that's the kind of fodder we need to make it through. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We read those, and they get incorporated into how we talk on the radio. We really do want to answer the questions that you have.
And you can actually go back and look at our newsletters and listen to our podcast from years ago and see if we were right.
Yeah. So until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.